We're going to take things out of a bit out of order. We understand Senator Morris needs to get to another meeting, et cetera. So we'll open a public hearing on SM2. Senator Morris, would you like to come up?
He's just a freshman, Madam Chair. Why are we being so nice to him?
Well, you know there's always time later for the things you want to do.
Madam Co-Chair, SM2 urges Congress to waive requirements for state matching funds and to decrease the requirements for state matching funds in order to receive federal funds.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the opportunity to testify on this. For the record, I'm Frank Morse, state senator from District 8. The driver for this is, I think it was spawned out of the experience that I have had on Human Services Ways and Means Subcommittee, listening to people testify over and over and over about the programs and services that we provide that offer a lifeline, literally, to thousands and thousands of people. And then to listen to them talk about the reductions that we have in the general fund and the corresponding impact that it has in federal funds. And I went home at night one night and I thought, well, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. Rules are made to be amended, revised, and changed. And Oregon, not being alone in this process of downsizing, maybe we could start something that would catch on at the congressional level that would allow us to keep our heads above water and not be punished for the economic recession that we're in. So that's the background behind this. I know there are those that feel the memorial resolutions are not worth the effort, but I would suggest that as we all look at the mail that comes to us from our constituents, we do look at it and we pay attention to it and we're sensitive to it. And I think in the same way we can represent the interests of the state of Oregon to our congressional delegation and request that they consider suspending the rules and allow at least some measure of federal dollars to be returned to us. And I say returned, as we all know, we generate those dollars, that does not penalize the thousands and thousands of people that depend on these services, because so much of the in particular, the DHS budget is the result. It's driven by federal dollars, and those are matching dollars, and we don't have them. So as we downsize, the compounding effect is really dreadful. So I'd ask that you pass this, allow me the privilege to present it to the floor for approval, and we can then distribute this to our congressional delegation and express the will of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I support your memorial, obviously. I think the only other thing I would add is it's unfortunate that we can't stop the federal government from always giving us penalties for how we administer programs. They don't think we administer them the way we should. And it's kind of disgusting sometimes when you realize we have to pay them back our money for not adhering to a program. But the bill is great the way it is, and I'm certainly supportive. Any questions of Senator Morris?
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I'm very, you know, I really think this is, as Senator Morris described it, an exercise in futility. But I think a larger point needs to be made, too, and that is that doing something like this is, in some sense, an abrogation of our own responsibilities as a state to provide those services. It becomes a chicken and an egg thing. You know, the federal government says if you do a better job on a particular part of law enforcement or child protective services or mental health for children, then we'll give you some matching money to help you do that. And then to turn around and say, we're not willing to raise the money ourselves, so don't give us any penalty for not giving us any money, is, in my view, kind of short-sighted. I mean, I respect what you're trying to do here on one level, but it sort of reverses the question of, you know, why we don't have the programs that we should have. And I mean, I think that and again, the way I come from this is a very unique place for a Democrat, and that has to do with the timber money for schools. Senator Farioli and I in 2001 had to fight like hell for $9 million out of 26, I think, that was scheduled for distressed timber communities in the state of Oregon, specifically addressed to those particular communities by Senator Smith and Senator Wyden and the folks that fought for us in D.C. to get that money. By the time that money got back to the state, we put $9 million in for rural schools and decided with the help of the education community that it was small rural high schools that needed the money the worst. So we plugged that $9 million into the formula and put the rest into the general fund. Now there's a move afoot during this session to take all the money and put it into the general fund. How are we going to get Congress to reallocate that money when we didn't use it for what it was intended for? So I applaud your efforts, but I really think that we should be really focusing in on why it is that we can't come up with the funding to get those matching funds. And what I do welcome about this is it really causes us to focus very directly, for instance, on the losses in Measure 28, where $300 million and a secret plan went up in smoke, but we also let go of $70 million in matching funds, in federal matching funds. So that's kind of my observation.
Thank you, Senator Corcoran, and I agree with you. I think I don't know if the timber receipts will ever be mandated on the federal level to be the way they're supposed to be or if they feel that's our job, but it is a frustrating situation, that's for sure. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, may I respond?
Yes.
I would just like to point out, thank you, Senator Corcoran, if the federal policies that have impacted rural Oregon were not in place, what would our economy look like today? And I think the federal government does have some responsibility with what it has done to rural America, particularly in the West, and the depletion of our ability to generate a living, in which obviously pays our taxes to make us work, by destroying the natural resource industries as they have in our state. So while we certainly have a responsibility to take care of ourselves, I think we do have an opportunity to reflect on the federal policies that have, and particularly in your district, tremendous history of timber, and it's different, and it's different for a reason, and that's the federal policy. So, you know, there's two sides to this issue, and I appreciate the one side of our responsibility that there is the federal issue as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
I can't let that one pass without a challenge. I mean, the fact of the matter is you probably better than anybody, Senator, know what the elements are that have impacted our natural resource policies, and you know that it's been everything from stepped-up production, from efficiencies in how many people are needed to produce the timber that's needed. You know probably better than anyone that it's the impact of our lack of ability to create tariffs and embargoes on foreign competition, their lack of both environmental and labor laws that drive us in this fight down to the bottom that have impacted those severely. It used to be that we could make that argument and say that it's just tree huggers versus the tree cutters, but when you know, the policy, the timber policy started affecting commercial fish, all of a sudden there were more regulations put in place. And in fact, Oregon was one of the national leaders in coming up with their own plan in terms of governing themselves with the Oregon Forest Practices Act. So, you know, again, with all due respect, I mean, there's a multitude of reasons why we don't look like we did 20, 25 years ago. But I think this dialogue of it's all the Fed's fault doesn't get us to a clear debate about the sufficiency and adequacy of our own resources and why that scenario exists.
Thank you, Senator Corcoran. Thank you, Senator Morse.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on SM2. And open a work session on SM2.
Madam Chair, We might want to wait on the work session.
Okay. Senator Burdick said his request we might want to hold on SM2. We will close the work session on SM2 and open a work session on public hearing and possible work session on SR26. SJR26.
SJR26. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Harper, a state senator from District 28. I try and frame the work that I do into trying to define the problem and try and develop a solution that fixes the problem, you know, in the most legitimate manner. Five special sessions led me to believe there may be a better way of doing business to some extent in the budgeting process. We got the Moody's downgrade letter, and I think I hope everybody had a chance to read this. This was quite instructive. But it had a couple of things that really struck home to me. The paragraph in there, 2% kicker will delay improvement in fiscal position. The kicker makes it difficult for the state to apply any of the dividend from economic growth towards building budgetary cushions. Unlike most other income tax-dependent states, Oregon did not have a significant reserve fund balance from which to draw to offset its weak revenue performance. There's another paragraph that references the rainy day fund has a positive long-term credit impact, the existing education endowment fund. So we have a revenue source, 70% plus, that's income tax. It's very volatile. We understand that. And I think the discussion in the building, the pre- and post-session, has been to modify our revenue sources, type and amount perhaps. And I think those tax restructuring, I think those are legitimate questions that we need to ask, and I think a thoughtful program, I'm sure that we'd be able to do in this body. But as a practical matter, 45 states out of 50 are in the deficit this biennium or this year. So the type of revenue and or the amount of revenue really is not the whole problem. We have a volatile source. But, as Moody says, we don't have a savings account. If we had a savings account, that would smooth out the volatility. And every other state has the same problem. So with a savings account, we would not have had six special sessions, I feel sure. So that leads to the concept of the Oregon Stability Fund. The Oregon Stability Fund, its purpose is to build a reserve fund that's equal to 6 months of general fund expenses, 6 months of cash flow, if you will, 6 months. And we fund it by suspending the kicker and by capping expenditures. So we have multiple revenue sources, the kicker revenue source and limit spending. If we would have been able to limit spending to some extent, we've talked about developing a rainy day fund, a savings account, since all of you have been in the building. We were never able to do it. So the Oregon Stability Fund funds it with those two sources. The discussion of the expenditure cap, well, what about Measure 5, Measure 11, those kind of things. We have a legislative override provision in there, so we can override for a biennium if that's the case. And we can, and the withdrawal and expenditure process is exactly the same withdrawal process that we developed for the Education Stability Fund, which we just recently did in Special Session 6. So you fill it up. When it gets full, you have 6 months of cash flow, which had we done this in 91, we would have had enough to get through. When it gets full, excess interest goes into it, and when it gets full, the excess goes into the common school fund. So you have the ability to draw on that off the common school fund with the interest. And that would be our stability fund. That would be our proposal to take care of the Moody's issue, take care of our issues by having to come back six times to balance the budget, you know, in 10 or 12 years. Next time we have a deep recession that we're in now. So that's where it came from. That's the problem. That's the proposed fix. And if I can answer any questions, I'd like to point out, excuse me, Madam Chair, but this is a constitutional revision, so it needs 20 votes on the floor. I'm assuming it needs two-thirds here, I assume, Jim. But it's a much higher level to get passed. So stability fund.
And you were speaking basically to the Dash 1 amendments as far as...
The Dash 1 amendments, that's correct, mm-hmm. Yeah. We're getting stuff, my perennial 2% ending balance bill that I can't get through, so this is what that is.
We've made it better, right?
Yeah, Dash 1s.
Any questions of the committee? Senator Atkinson.
Senator Harper. When you suspend the kicker to build the fund up, what would trigger the kicker to go back? Or another way to ask it, how long would it be suspended?
Until the fund gets full, until we get 6 months reserve.
So once it's stays at 6 months, and it would essentially go back to the constitutional amendment?
Correct.
And I haven't read all the amendments yet since we just got them, but does it, if you equal to 6 months of cash flow?
Based upon the previous biennium's last two quarters is
okay.
How we define it.
Okay.
So it's kind of, it's a moving number, if you will.
A moving amount in that reserve.
Yeah, the most okay. Current.
Further
and
questions?
That, just for purposes of this year, that's about $2.5 billion, roughly.
Two and a half. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I don't have my bill file in front of me, so I apologize. But just so I understand, if it were ever to get used and depleted, would it automatically re-trigger these two areas to build the fund back again a second time?
No.
It's a one-time deal.
We'd have to revisit it, yeah.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, and I apologize. I've just received these as well. So the amount of the kicker, if the kicker kicks in if it's over 2% past projections.
Correct.
So the entire amount that would ordinarily appear in kicker checks would go into the rainy day fund?
That's correct.
And but I see here, it looks to me like when the fund fills up under the Dash 1 amendments, then if the fund is full, I heard you say that the proceeds would go into the common school fund, or
when the fund gets full, the other revenue sources, primarily interest and appropriations limits, if it gets full, they flow into the common school fund.
But once the fund is full, then the kicker starts being refunded to taxpayers again.
Mm-hmm.
And what? Madam Chairman, thank you.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
What was your basis for 8%?
That is a 4% a year, 8% a biennium. That's really based on a number of things, Senator Burdick. The federal government uses a 4% annual growth for most of their domestic programs. It is an adequate, I think, a fair growth on an annual basis. Across the general fund, it just seemed like a reasonable number to go with.
Well, Madam Chairman, I over the past few years since I've been in office, mm-hmm. I think the 8% is about, before this previous recession, I'm not a numbers person like my honorable colleague, you, so forgive me if I'm a little off, but it seems to me that the rate of increase for schools with K through 12 education has been around 8%, and that has not been regarded by the quality education model and most education professionals, certainly around the state, and most parents, at least the parents in my district, as being anywhere near adequate. And the other programs have had larger increases because of increased caseloads and a number of other factors, increases in population of, you know, between 15% and 17%. And again, forgive me if I'm a little off on these numbers, but in both cases, the social programs and the education, 8% seems very, very austere based on our experience with growth, population growth, and other factors.
Well, actually, you've heard this term population as another, that's what Colorado has in their constitution, which is just another way of looking at it. That gets you into, we've had population growth and CPI growth of somewhere between 1 and 2% over the last decade. So this is double that that indicator. I had a bill in 99 session that used a percent of personal income. I mean, there are several different data sets that you can use to do this. I was trying to get something that was simple, easily understood, took care of modest growth, but what happened to us in the 90s, we were growing at double-digit rates, 15, 18, 22% one year, and we didn't save any of that. And I'd suggest that if we'd have done this, we would have had $2.5 billion in the Stability Fund and $5 billion in the Common School Fund. Now, obviously, this is revisionist history because we weren't dealing with this at the time. But if you can save something, you know, this thing started with a 2% ending balance. If you can save something, spend at the 98th or 97th percentile, and the kicker is a portion of this that is identified as being a problem to long-term strategic savings. So I'm offering up this if you'll offer up some kind of an appropriation limit.
And Madam Chair, and I really commend you for coming forward with a rainy day fund. I looked all through the dash ones, and I didn't see the word "hell freezes over" in any place here. But that's the only information I have.
I got to tell you, I'm glad I'm a concealed permit carrier.
So I do commend you for addressing this issue. I am concerned. Whether I don't think it helps our credibility or the process in general to put a cap on that is unrealistically tight, that we're going to have to be having a major struggle over every session. And we did have that growth in the 90s, but we went through five special sessions in which proved beyond any doubt to me that it's hard, very, very hard to deny services that Oregonians have come to expect.
This is my idea. I'd ask, what's your idea to build a savings account, to build a real savings account? Even the Education Stability Fund is capped at about $500 million in that vicinity, if I recall. So I don't want to do to the next legislature what the previous legislature did to us. Six special sessions, we are permanently traumatized. So without having a savings account, no matter what we do, we have to have a savings account. And I'll give you my kicker, but you've got to put in some kind of spending, reasonable spending limit. What we're dealing with in the budget, notwithstanding anything else, is we have a finite amount of resources, and we have a lot of good people that are working very hard to make those things go as far as they can, and that's what we're trying to do. I say, if you know that you're going to have 8% growth, you can sit down, plan, develop programs consistently year after year so you know where you are. That's just long-term strategic planning. I think it would work. We see it work all over the country. You ask where that number came from, that just seems to me to be a reasonable number, but make me an offer.
And Madam Chair, I think,
don't forget there's always the override in here, which came out of discussions kind of around the table.
Yeah, and I commend you for that. I think the concept, if we were to keep our current tax system the income tax system, it could be made more stable through something like a savings account. So again, I want to commend you, and you are actually the best messenger I could think of in this building to come forward with this.
Well, don't get misled by the fact if we rework the tax system, we'll fix all our problems. That's what I really want to make that point. Every taxing system known to man is in a deficit, in a recession across the country. So whatever we do, Jenny, however we revise this thing, and I think we need to legitimately approach it in a revision mode, we've got to have a savings account. Whatever we do, tax-wise, that's what I'm... And I've got a funding source here that looks like it's a reasonable approach to it to get us built up to 6 months of emergency funds.
And 6 months of emergency funds is a good amount, but at the same time, it wouldn't have been enough in the last special session.
Actually, it would have. We're short 2.1, and this, if we would have done this, you know, depending on when you start, in the 91-93 time frame, to accommodate the Measure 5 issues.
You mean 01-03? Oh, you mean starting in 91?
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's, yeah. I say that's, you know, that's kind of fake money. That's like the mutual funds profit forecast. But just as an example, anything we would have done, you know, I had one in 01-03 that we couldn't get through the body. We've had them every year. We can't seem to discipline ourselves to sock money away. And this is an automatic discipline. I don't know how you guys save for your retirement accounts, but mine comes out of my check before it ever gets to my house. And this is something similar to that. The kicker has me very concerned because I'm sitting down there with the numbers people this biennium, because we're not going to fix the volatility of this biennium. We're going to be very volatile in 04. Very volatile. So I think we need to prepare to be able to save that, but you've got to give me something also to make that, so I can make the case to my people. You have to make the case to your people, because it's going to demand a constitutional amendment. And I think both of us can do this, making our respective cases to our respective folks, but none of us can do it alone.
Thank you, Senator. And as Senator Burdick mentioned, it's one thing to oppose something, say taking away the kicker or something, but there's another thing if you come in with a solution. And even though not everyone may be 100% on all the solution that's presented, but at least you've come in with a solution.
It's my idea.
Good idea.
What's your idea?
Yeah. Good idea. Any further discussion? Thank you, Senator
Thanks.
Harper.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing and work session on SJR 26. And
yes.
Open a public hearing and work session on SCR 4.
Madam Co-Chair, SCR 4 memorializes the life and work of Ruth Asher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Abel Gordley. I represent Senate District 23 in Cortland. It is a real pleasure and privilege to be associated with the concurrent resolution before you today. I'm going to speak very briefly and then ask my colleague, Senator Brown, and my other dear colleague, Sharon Hill, to speak. In fact, Sharon is most responsible for this Senate concurrent resolution being before the committee this afternoon. Ruth Asher had the privilege of meeting her, working with her all too briefly in the mid to late 90s as work was going forward to get the state to at last acknowledge disparities in access to health care and treatment for Oregon's racial and ethnic minorities. At that time, Ruth was working with the state health division around multicultural health issues. And what I'd like to say about her, reflecting on the time that I knew her, which again was just all too brief, is that her work set the stage for work that is now being accomplished through the governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. This is a task force that was first appointed by Governor Kitzhaber, a task force that we expect to be reappointed under our current governor. Ruth was a visionary. She was quiet, thoughtful, reflective, a great writer. I can remember attending a human rights rally in downtown Portland. Huge crowd, very noisy at first, but as Ruth spoke, as she delivered her remarks, the crowd became not just quiet, but still, and literally hung on to her every eloquent word. She always spoke with such thoughtfulness and eloquence and strength. And there's an African proverb that comes to mind when I think about her, and I think about her now, and the proverb says, "You have struck a rock." And that's how I think of Ruth Asher, this phenomenal woman who was a woman of great strength and great courage, and she was a rock.
Thank you. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 21, and I'd like to share a letter from the family members that are here today. And it says, "Dear Madam Chair and members of the committee, we are here today as a group to provide written testimony in support of Senate Concurrent Resolution 4. We are Bernard Asher, Daryl Asher, Lisa Moffitt, and Kenneth Asher. We reside in Southeast Portland, and we are the family of Ruth Asher. We ask that Ruth be considered for this honor, not because she was and continues to be the anchor of our family, but because she is so incredibly worthy of this honor. Though her family was the dearest thing to her, Ruth found an enormous amount of time to devote her assistance to many individuals and organizations throughout the state of Oregon. We were amazed at the full extent of her involvement in her work to improve the lives of others. Ruth was a quiet yet determined woman who did not boast of her efforts. She carried on without fanfare, although she received numerous awards and accolades from several organizations. The Hispanic community in particular, along with many minority groups in the state, have benefited from her boundless energy as an advocate for their rights. Her family and friends have been, and always will be, extremely proud of her. She was an amazing woman and an incredible mother. Ruth left this earth on January 25th, 2 months ago today, but she has not, and nor shall she ever, leave our hearts. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, the Asher family."
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Sharon Hill from Southeast Portland, 3516 Southeast Alder, and a constituent of Senator Brown's. I wanted to thank you for hearing this resolution. I want to thank Senator Brown and Senator Avell Gordley for sponsoring the resolution acknowledging the work and the life of Ruth Asher. I also want to thank Ruth's family and just to acknowledge that Daryl and Ken and Lisa, as her children, and her husband Bernard and her brother John Lopez are here. And I want to thank them for sharing Ruth with all of us and with the Oregonians across the state. We as a people, as community, and as a state are better for the work and the life of Ruth Asher. Today, as mentioned, marks 2 months since Ruth's passing. Her passing is still difficult for family and friends. She was such a proud, fun, and loving mother, and her children are a reflection of her compassion and her love. Ruth was a seemingly ordinary woman, a daughter, a sister, a wife, a mother, who lived an extraordinary life, giving voice to the marginalized, speaking justice for the oppressed, and sharing resources and support to communities across the state. As her friend Carolina Hess, Ruth's co-chair and compadre with the Hispanic Services Roundtable, said, Senate Concurrent Resolution 4 is a wonderful act of justice for Ruth's memory. I want to share some of Ruth's enduring legacy and the importance of SCR 4. It is an acknowledgement of the effort she fostered for the betterment of all Oregonians across this state. As the resolution notes, she was a founding member of a number of organizations. The Latino Network and the Hispanic Services Roundtable are two. She received national and community recognition. She worked against domestic violence. She worked to share support, information, and resources about HIV and AIDS, not just in communities of color, but across rural Oregon. She traveled to communities across this state to assist and support folks locally where they lived. You'll find many a person that will talk about driving through the state of Oregon, sharing stories on the way to a community that Ruth was a resource for and an anchor for. She was forward-thinking. Ruth kept raising the concern in the early 1990s at the state level, at the county level, and at the community level that the rapidly growing Hispanic population in Oregon was underreported in the 1990 census, and that the underreporting adversely affected appropriate funding and available services at every level. There are some who paved the path for so many others to follow and prosper. And Ruth was an Oregon trailblazer, directing us into the 21st century, embracing our growing diversity across the state. To me, her work and that of her Office of Multicultural Health Manager, Barbara Taylor, represents the preparatory work that Senator Gordley's already talked about that led to the Governor's Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force work. When I served as chair of the Oregon Council on Civil and Human Rights that advised the Labor Commissioner, I asked Ruth to serve with me on the council amongst her many other obligations. She didn't hesitate. We worked to explore the civil rights aspects of barriers to health care access, particularly among Oregon's racial and ethnic communities. As a doctoral student at Portland State, I know that we can make economic and public health arguments that can be made that racial and ethnic health disparities are critical indicators to the health and quality of life for all Oregonians. To Oregon's credit, Ruth and Barbara's earlier work, their experience, their expertise, their technical assistance, their voices, led to the elevation of these issues to the point that we have a governor's task force on racial and ethnic health and the support, legislative leadership support over the years for that. Much of work is ahead, but the path has been blazed at the local community level, across the state, and at the highest political levels. I still see Ruth smile, and I hear her laugh, and she continues to inspire me. It is important to our state's history to acknowledge our trailblazers who lifted their voice for so many others and set us on a more prosperous and embracing path for all Oregonians. I urge your support for SCR 4, acknowledging the extraordinary life of my friend and mentor, Ruth Asher. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Any discussion? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing and open a work session on SCR 4.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move Senate Concurrent Resolution 4 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick has moved SCR 4 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. Senator Gordley and Senator Brown will carry the bill, the resolution. Close the work session on SCR 4. We thank the family for being here today and extend our sincere and deepest sympathies to you. Open a work session on SCR 3. Jim?
Yes, Senator Carno, I see there are three you dealt with on the 6th of March. Congratulate the University of Portland Kyles women's soccer team. They were the 2002 NCAA Division I national champions. We have a Dash 1 amendment that I believe you have a copy of, which adds the name of their excellent coach, Clive Charles.
If I remember correct, when we, Cleve, yes, Coach Cleve Charles?
Yes. Yes.
When we had a public hearing on this, I remember that we had needed the Dash 1 amendments. So we'll need
Madam
to
Chair.
Senator Brown.
I would move the Dash 1 amendments to SCR 3.
Senator Brown moves the Dash 1 amendments to SCR 3. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. Senator Brown.
I would move SCR 3 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator,
never mind. I take that back. I guess it is in a pass.
It's an adopt. But you
adoption.
Want to, you
adoption.
Want to, as amended, as
thank you. SCR 3 as amended to the floor for adoption.
Senator Brown moves SCR 3 to the as adopted to the floor with
as amended
with a due adopt recommendation. Any objection? Any discussion first? Pardon me. Any objection? If not, so moved. Close the work session on SCR 3. Senator Carter carries. Okay. Next.
You could be a work session on the building section for this.
Yes, I'm ready.
Is there? Okay. We'll open a public hearing on SJM 3. Judy Brown, would you like to come forward? While you're coming forward, I'll have the administrator tell us about the bill.
Yes, Senator Carno, SJM 3 urges Congress to require captioning in education media.
Ms. Brown, welcome. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
My name is Judy Brown. I'm from Carleton, Oregon, and I'm here to testify in support of SJM 3. I'm the grandmother, co-chair Brown, Clarino, and committee members. I'm the grandmother of a mainstream 14-year-old oral deaf child, and I also serve as children's rights coordinator for the A.G. Bell Association for the Deaf. I'm supporting this because students like my granddaughter are increasingly being placed in inclusive classrooms where they learn alongside of their hearing peers. And as media is becoming increasingly prevalent in our classrooms, children who are deaf and hard of hearing simply are being left out when a media activity takes place. It's going to get worse instead of better for these children, as we all know. The Telecommunications Act of 96 mandated captioning for TV programming, but they didn't address educational captioning. And so there really aren't any federal laws mandating captioning for our students. I've enclosed on the back of my testimony a little summation of captioning and federal law as it now exists. Captioned media, of course, is crucial to these students who have hearing loss, and It's a feeling of many of us in the community, the family members and those working with deaf and hard of hearing children, that the producers of educational videos simply are not aware of the need. It's a minority group issue, and nobody has really organized any kind of an effort on their behalf. However, I would like to point out that during the last session of the Oregon Legislature, SJR 28 was also introduced by Senator George, supported by the Oregon School Boards Association and the Amhill Education Service District, as well as Oregon AG Bell and many other groups. It was passed overwhelmingly, and the OSBA then took this resolution to the National School Boards Association, and it was also approved there. And what that kind of shows me is that once folks are aware of this issue, they're more than happy to support it. legislative approval of SJM 3 will send a strong message to Congress, the Federal Communications Commission, and our congressional delegation that Oregonians recognize the need for captioned media to help these children learn. And that's about all I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions of Ms. Brown? Thank you very much. You've just answered everything.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing and open a work session on SJM 3. Senator Brown?
Madam Chair, I would move SJM 3 to the Senate floor with a due pass approval recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Senator Brown moves SJM 3 to the Senate floor with a due adopt recommendation.
I don't know.
Any questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
What
Senator Brown? Due pass approval recommendation.
And is it does it require a double majority?
Senator Brown, I think you're just being given a rough
I think
time.
The witness was so good she rattled Senator Brown, which is not easy to do.
Madam Chair, since it is not technically a bill, we don't exactly pass it, so I assume that we approve it, so I'm encouraging a due pass recommendation on the approval of this SJR.
Madam Chair, does that mean that Senator Brown, that's her story and she's sticking with it?
It's her story. I think she's sticking with it. And she's on top of things, so I'm going to recommend it. If there is no further discussion, that we adopt Senator Brown's motion. So moved. Close the work session on SJM 3. Congratulations, Ms. Brown. And Senator George will carry this bill.
And for the record, we're not related that I am aware of.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm surprised she didn't come up with that.
Okay, how about SJM 5 next?
I'm ready. I'm
going to open a public hearing on SJM 5.
Members, if you're having trouble finding the measure summaries because your staff has made an error, I know that's hard to believe, but we made an error. We said SJR 5. It should be SJM 5, and this is the Action Plan for Public Lands and Education. It seeks just compensation from the federal government for the impact of federal land ownership on the funding of public education and urges the federal government to expedite land exchange.
Thank you, committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 21. I'd like to thank my colleagues, my caucus leaders, and Senator Atkinson for signing on to this resolution. I would certainly encourage all of you to sign on to this resolution. I am the vice chair of CSG West and have been involved with CSG programs for a few years at this point in time, and this resolution comes to you from the Council of State Governments West. And they're urging all of the Western states to pass similar initiatives. Western states as a group are falling behind in education funding when measured in growth of real per pupil expenditures from 1979 to 1998. For instance, 11 of the 12 states with the lowest real growth in per pupil expenditures are Western states. Despite the fact that Western states tax at a comparable rate and allocate as much of their budgets to public education, Western states nevertheless have higher per pupil, per teacher ratios and lower growth in per pupil expenditures. I could have done a slide presentation, but I was concerned about your ability to hear all of the measures that we have today in a timely manner. So, but I'm happy to present that at any time should you desire it. On the average, the 13 Western states have 3 more students per classroom than the 37 other states. So the huge question is, why does this happen? The problem lies with the federal government and the enormous amount of land it owns in the Western states. For instance, no state west of Montana has less than 27% of its land federally owned, not counting Hawaii. This affects Western states' ability to fund public education in 3 ways. Number 1, through enabling acts.
Most Western states' enabling acts promise 5% of the proceeds from the sale of federal land to the state for public education. However, the federal government has abandoned its policy to dispose of public lands. Number two, property taxes. States cannot assess property tax on federal lands, which, as you know, public education depends heavily on for state and local property tax revenues. In Oregon, it's estimated that we lose $175 million in annual property tax revenues. In terms of school trust lands, at statehood, the federal government transferred ownership of specified parcels of land to the states as a trust for public education. Most of this trust land is difficult to administer and make productive, for a number of reasons that I'm sure we can have a number of discussions about. The federal government does provide what we call, quote, payment in lieu of taxes, end quote, or known as PILF, since states cannot tax federal land. However, the amount of these payments to Western states in 2001 was only about 4% of the annual property tax revenues lost by Western states. So what does this mean for Oregon? Oregon loses $782 million in one-time revenue and $627 million in ongoing revenue on an annual basis. Roughly on a biannual basis, it would be about $1.2 billion. That would help substantially in terms of our resolving our school funding issue. SJM 5 asks for just compensation for Oregon from the federal government for the impact that federal ownership of land has on the ability to fund public education. It also asks the federal government to provide an expedited land exchange for land not intended for wilderness designation, and that's to avoid what I call the checkerboard effect. So I would be happy to answer any questions, and I would ask for your support of this memorial.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Any questions of Senator Brown? Senator Corcoran, this is your opportunity to interrogate.
Well, just to be consistent, I mean, I take issue with this just as much as I took issue with Senator Morris's memorial. I mean, you know, the education is a state's responsibility, and, you know, I'd have to think about what the ramifications are of, you know, one-time sale of federal property, how we would get money. We've got a war going on and a huge federal deficit being created right in front of our eyes, and we're going to ask the federal government for more compensation. Doesn't seem like especially good timing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Corcoran. Well, I do appreciate that the vast majority of school funding dollars are the responsibility of the states. It's also true that the federal government has imposed a number of mandates from the new Leave No Child Behind, fondly known as the Nuckleby Act, to the IDEA mandate, the IDEA mandate, which mandates that we provide for the special education, special needs education for children in our school systems. And the harsh reality, as Senator Corcoran, is that the federal government had agreed to pay 40% of the IDEA mandate, and they are only at this point in time paying 17%. Of those costs. And so I think basically what the purpose of this memorial is to ask the federal government to live up to its commitments that it's made in terms of the federal lands being held in Western states.
Madam Chair, I guess that would beg the question of why we didn't do that specific memorial then, as opposed to this overreaching, you know, the West gets screwed because of federal control of lands. If we want to make the point that they're not giving us enough support in IDEA money, and if we want to make the point that Leave No Child Behind is just this exercise in unfunded mandates, then why don't we go after those particular programs and write that particular memorial as opposed to this more generalized kind of issue? I mean, there's all kinds of groups that would take issue with, you know, what those state lands should be used for. I have my ideas about certain parts of the Willamette National Forest, but I'm not sure that begging to the feds at this point is very productive.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Corcoran, I appreciate your concerns. I do think that the states, the western states, have a specific circumstances in common that would result in our heading to ask for special efforts from our congressional delegation.
Senator Brown, excellent job. I will not ask for further participation. Is there any other comments? Thank you, Senator Brown.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 5 and open work session on Senate Joint Memorial Number 5.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
I would move SJM 5 to the floor.
Senator Atkinson moves with a do adopt recommendation. SJM 5 is moved with a do adopt by Senator Atkinson. Any discussion? Any objection?
Objection.
Record Senator Corcoran as an objection. The SJM 5 is moved. Senator Brown, would you like to have Senator Atkinson carry this with you?
I would love to.
Senator Atkinson and Senator Brown will be joint carriers. We don't have any. Okay, let's move on to measure drafting and introduction requests. I'll open a work session on measure drafting and introduction requests for committee approval. Jim.
Madam Co-Chair, each member has a list of five items that have been approved. There is a sixth item that is a draft that you approved previously for relating to consent to conduct autopsy from Senator Courtney. The other five items are LC 3502, LC 3517, a drafting request from Senator Minnis on Occupational Profession Licensing Board Authority, from Senator Winters and from Senator Shields. The Winters and Shields measures were measures that they are currently working on, went to amend and discovered that the amendments that they wanted were outside of the scope of the relating clause, so all they would like to do is get a new vehicle so that those amendments would fit.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
I would move that we approve the following request. LC 3502 for introduction, a drafting request from Senator Minnis for filing by rules, a drafting request for Senator Winters on the Oregon State Fair, a drafting request for Senator Shields on a faith-based and community organizations, and for LC 315, a measure introduction, and for the Senate President, a measure introduction.
Senator Brown moves LC 3502, the request from Senator Minnis, from Senator Winters, from Senator Shields, and LC 3517. Any discussion? And the Senate President. Where is that?
It's the one that is to add on one of the showed you before. It's the one that
and for, and the
consent to conduct autopsy.
Okay. And the measure by Senator Courtney. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, so moved. Committee? We are.
Holy smokes.
Yes. Did we go smoking or not? Okay. I mean, did we go fast? We are adjourned. Got here just in time.
For the record, note that I...